Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward together. That's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsinized Look at This Week in Politics and the Capitol. J.R., I want to open with, well, the state budget is not setting up yet. But here's one thing it is setting up. This fight over high-capacity wells in Central Sands. Long public hearing this week. And it's a huge issue. It's very emotional. Deal with groundwater. The number one users of groundwater statewide is our vegetable and farmer, potatoes. 400 billion gallons. High-capacity wells pump 291 billion gallons of water just in the Central Sands area, 2011 and 15. So it's an early pre-budget priority, isn't it?
For some people, it is definitely. Scott Fitzgerald, interestingly, put his name on this bill this time around. So you have to go back last session. The two houses passed competing bills, and that's why it died.
Right.
They couldn't get together on a couple of provisions of this. Fitzgerald said he wants to bring it back. He's now on the bill. So that kind of gives the impression of this is a priority for Scott Fitzgerald, the majority leader. The question, though, continues to be, can the two houses get in the same spot? Because in the assembly, Scott Krug, who is from the Central Sands region, has still got concerns about the Senate bill. He's working on, I've talked to him, he's working on his own amendments. He wants a couple tweaks. So we'll see how that plays out. But you maybe Fitzgerald can get through one house, but what about the other house? And can they get the same bill through both houses on the governor's desk? That's going
to
be the test.
It's such an emotional, controversial bill that I want to take a few minutes to listen to Senator Fitzgerald and Representative Gary Talkin. He's the assembly co-sponsor. Say why that bill is needed. So let's go to the video from this week's hearing, please.
Just as Wisconsin relies on agriculture industry to support our state's economy, this industry relies on high-capacity wells to support their day-to-day operations. These wells are an integral part of Wisconsin's farming operations. By allowing the repair, replacement, or reconstruction of existing DNR-approved high-capacity wells, this bill gives certainty to farmers, businesses, and municipalities who are the biggest user of not only water, but high-capacity wells. If the legislature determines that additional regulation is needed for new high-capacity wells, certainly something I'm not opposed to revisiting, those changes should apply to new permits going forward and not looking backwards at permits and permit holders who are in compliance with the law. This bill maintains stringent environmental compliance and well construction standards, as well as DNR authority and oversight. If a replacement well is constructed to prevent contamination, the existing well must be filled and sealed in accordance with DNR rules. If a well is replaced, reconstructed, or transferred, the owner of the well must notify the DNR within 90 days. Any conditions that applied to the original permit continue to apply to the reconstructed or replacement well. As a result of the concerns over groundwater impacts in the Central Sands region, this legislation also requires the DNR to do a study evaluating and modeling the hydrology of specific lakes, rivers, and watersheds in Adams, Green Lake, Juneau, Marquette, Portage, Wapaka, Washera, Winnebago, and Wood counties. Wisconsin has a strong permitting system for the placement of high-capacity wells. For a small farm or business that goes through the time and expense to get such a permit, they need certainty that they will be able to continue to operate under that permit. They also need the ability to maintain these wells without fear that doing so will trigger new costly permitting.
This bill assures that the highest well construction code standards will be applied to any reconstructed, repaired, or replaced wells. It maintains DNR authority. It makes it clear that the transferred, reconstructed, repaired, or replaced high-capacity well must comply with the original requirements set by the DNR-approved permit. SB 76 and AB 105 does not affect the current statutory authority granted to the DNR to pursue an order or a legal case in order to protect the state's navigable waters from any nuisance or any infringement of public rights. This legislation does not allow for any new groundwater withdrawals, nor does this bill streamline the application process for new high-capacity wells. It simply protects the rights of landowners who already have a DNR-approved high-capacity well.
Okay, JR, before we listen to an opponent who turned the hearing into kind of a show-and-tell, mm-hmm. let's talk about the political realities. We're largely talking about the 24th Senate District.
Yep.
If you look 6 years ago, the 24th Senate District and the three assembly districts that make that up, they were 3 to 4 Democrats. Fast forward now, mm-hmm. and 3 of the 4 are Republicans, with the defeat of Julie Lassa by Patrick Teston, mm-hmm. and Vandermeer defeated Amy Sue mm-hmm. Vruwink,
yep.
and Katrina Shanklin is the only Democrat in this area in central Wisconsin. So I noticed new Senator Patrick Teston is not on Fitzgerald's bill as of yesterday. So what? This is a politically sensitive, very politically sensitive for central Wisconsin.
Absolutely. You have, on the one hand, you have the producers. They need the water.
Yep.
You also have the people who live on lakes and streams who enjoy that, who are saying, wait a second, something's going on where you put too many straws in the drink and you're saying we can't measure the impact? What's going on here?
Right. It's very emotional. And which takes us to Carol Elvery, who show-and-telled with some props at this committee hearing. This is very interesting. Let's listen to Carol Elvery, who's an opponent of the Fitzgerald-Talkin bill.
I could tell you about the damage already done to Radley Creek, a Class 1 trout stream just south of Waupaca, which is about to experience more damage due to the fact that a fourth well previously denied was approved after the AG's opinion last fall. Or I could tell you about how the flow in the water at Hartman Creek, the state park of the same, that flows through the state park of the same name, has been reduced by half in the 6 years since volunteers have been monitoring water levels. The major difference is the presence or absence of high-capacity wells nearby. But let me show you how it works. And for this, I need some audience help. This cup is a lake, and that's the water level. And if each person would just take a mouthful of water. Now, this fourth person, I want you to see what's happened to the water level from these three high-capacity wells. Now, the fourth person here is a lake association that has been granted permission to put a high-capacity well into the lake and into the ground and pump water to refill the lake. Let's see how successful she is at that. And now you can let it all go back, and it will refill. But you see, it can't even fully refill. My point is that the provision in the bill that lake associations could just pump water in to refill the lake, it doesn't work that way. It's still being pulled out. There's one other little point that can be a problem with this water level bit going down. So this is a lake with lots of water, and a little bit of pollution goes in, probably fertilizer, chemicals, maybe manure, who knows. And then this is a lake whose water level has reduced, maybe like Huron Lake. So I put one drop in each one, and you will notice, not a lot of water difference, generally, that this would be more concentrated and would be sooner or later would be more of a water quality problem.
Committee hearing is kind of a science lab. Very quick question to exit this issue, JR. Do you think we'll get a vote in the Senate on this before we get into the heavy-duty budget stuff?
Good question. I think Fitzgerald wants to move it. The indication from back at the beginning of the session is you want to move it and move it soon. So they're working that way, it looks like, right now.
Okay, let's turn the page. Speaker Ryan is in the middle of this health care debate. Mm-hmm. And he said this week, this is a plan we ran on all last year. This is a plan we've been working with House, Senate, White House. But now, he says, now as we get close to the finish going through the committee process, you inevitably make these refinements, amendments, tweaks. But now yesterday, the 3 of 4 House committees approved it. Mm-hmm. But when you look at what Tom Cotton, who is 8 years younger than the 47-year-old speaker, says, the so-called three-phase plan talk is nothing but politicians' talk. It's all talk. The House has moved much too quickly. And I was so intrigued, before I turn the stage over to you, Ron Johnson said, I don't see enough reforms in the House bill, in the Ryan bill, that will actually bring down the premiums. I'm not an alarmist here. Like, if we don't do this in 2 weeks, we lose our chance. I'd rather take the time and get this right. Where is the speaker on health care?
Well, just before I came over here, I saw that they announced they're going to vote next week on Thursday.
Are they?
On the bill?
Full
House? It looks
full
like.
House?
What's interesting is Ryan has been portraying this as a one-shot deal, and not just on health care but in this bill, but if they don't get this bill done, they won't get done their entire agenda. We're talking tax reform, mm-hmm. the budget, the whole nine yards. So he has put invested a lot of his personal capital into this. At one point, he was saying this bill is the bill. It cannot be changed. But now he's saying, well, we're going to make some tweaks to get it through. He's in this very difficult position of more conservative members of the caucus saying this is not what we want. But if he moves to the right, to those folks, he might lose some moderate Republicans who are nervous about this. He has room. He can lose, 16, 17 people, something like that, so he'll pass it. So he might get through his House, but now the Senate becomes a problem. The Democrats so far seem unified against the bill. He's got Cotton. He's got Rand Paul.
Collins.
Collins.
Senator Collins came out against it.
Rand Paul had a couple of interesting comments.
Ted Cruz is saying nothing nice about it. Excuse me.
So you have all these folks who are raising concerns about it, and the problem for the House is, for Ryan, to get this done as is, the process called reconciliation, you need, I think, 51 votes?
Yeah, you do, because you escape the filibuster rule in the Senate.
Yes. So he needs 51 votes, and he's got an issue with that right now. And, oh, by the way, they're trying to sell down this three-step process to explain why they're not doing it all in one shot. Well, we have to meet the reconciliation process, do it this way, but we'll follow up these two bills that'll make sure everything better. And guys are going, no, this is not what we want.
Why should the Ryan-led U.S. House pass a bill that will not pass the Senate? Why should the House pass it next Thursday?
They've put the reputation. They've been running against Obamacare since the day they passed it, even before they passed it. In 2009, they're already raising the alarm bells about this, right? This has been like their marching order since then, of we are going to repeal this thing. Well, now it was in 2012. You need the President and the Senate to pass a repeal. They didn't get either. 2014, they got the Senate. Well, we can't get anything without the President. Now, in 2016, they've got the House, the Senate, and the President's office. If they can't get this done, what's the ramification for them going forward? They've failed. This has been their charge. How do you explain that to people, that we couldn't deliver on our promise?
Well, we have a Wisconsin speaker deep in the middle of this. It's going to be so fascinating. I had occasion to interview Milwaukee Mayor Barrett this week. And in the course of that, I asked him about his thoughts on the health care debate, and he recalled when he was a member of the U.S. House in 1993, after the Clinton election, when Bill and Hillary Clinton touched the same third rail. And so let's listen to just about a minute of Tom Barrett recalling how this is not going to work out very well for President Trump.
I think what's going to happen is we're going to see how the Trump administration plays out, because the Republicans had their fun. If you go back to 1993, when I was serving in Congress, that's when Bill Clinton had his health care plan. The Democrats had their heads handed to them on a platter in 1994 because they tried to move on health care. In 2009, 2010, the Democrats again tried to move forward on health care, and they paid dearly at the polls. Now the Republicans are the ones that are trying to move on health care. If you have 24 million people, more people, who are without insurance, to me that's a moral issue. That is a moral issue. How this nation could say, oh yeah, we're going to let 24 million people go without health care so we can give a tax break to the richest people in this country, I think you are going to see a much different election, and I think people will be standing in line to run for all these offices.
Which brings us back to this. Yesterday on the House Budget Committee, Congressman Grossman voted for it, provided a critical vote for it. Do you think Barrett's right that health care is going to be a defining issue in 2018?
Absolutely. And Grossman said that he voted for it in committee with the assumption he's going to get changes where it goes to final vote on the floor later on. So he's got his own caveats, this entire thing. But yes, health care, I had Democrats tell me this week that Paul Ryan and Republicans have taken health care from a liability for Democrats to a position of strength, because Ryan is finding out the change between being a party of opposition to party of governing. And they're having a hard time pushing this through. I mean, one of the questions that's been raised this week or recent weeks has been, so wait, you've had 6 years to figure this out and this is the best you can do? And they're defending, which is interesting, they're trying to defend that this is a good deal because, yes, people have coverage, but you'll have better access and more affordable health care. So is it about covering people or access to affordable health care? Because Republicans keep saying Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is too expensive. It's cost prohibitive for people. It's not the right way to do things. Their system is better, but fewer people get covered. So what's the right answer there?
Well, part of the blood on this issue this week was the CBO report.
Mm-hmm.
Within a year, 14 million more are not going to have insurance, but it's important to note that some of those are going to be perhaps young millennials who say, without the mandate, the gun to my head, I don't need insurance.
And the argument has been from some folks that, well, that's the way it should be, that you shouldn't force people to have to do something they don't want to do. This is America. That's not how it works. The problem is, for any insurance pool to work, you need low-risk people to pay into it to offset the cost of the high-risk people. And our low-risk people in healthcare are the young because they have fewer health problems.
Yeah, and in the wake of the CBO report, the score, Speaker Ryan said, here's a number I like. It's going to reduce federal deficits by $337 billion mm-hmm. over 10 years. Okay, fascinating. Another serious issue emerged this week when Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley said, look, we have to consider merging with the state pension system. And I just want to go through some of the facts that he threw out in that press release. What Milwaukee County pays annually for its pension system has gone up 360% since he took office, from $10.1 million to $46.8 million. Point two, the county has paid out more than $293 million in backdrop payments since 2002 and will likely have to pay another $100 million to 1,200 additional employees. Finally, we need to explore a comprehensive overhaul to include, among other things, studying a move to the state pension system. He also noted that Wisconsin is the only fully funded state pension system. Mm-hmm. Here's my question. This is so important. Why should a very solvent state pension system pick up a Milwaukee County pension system that is so deeply in the red?
That's an excellent question. I
don't
understand.
How do you smooth that out?
I don't understand the risk involved or to tell you what the interest the state would have. Now, I mean, the Milwaukee pension does have assets, right? So they say they're going to meet current demands or whatever it is. But this thing has been a mess. Go back 15 years now.
Yes.
The golden parachutes that Thomas
Ament
pushed through.
And they can't even compute the pensions correctly. It cost Milwaukee County the last pension director. How do you?
There was the widow of a sheriff's deputy who's being overpaid now, and what do they do? It's an absolute mess, and it is a drain on our largest county every year on the resources they have to pay for other things. It's a problem for them.
Well, Abley has proven that he can do deals mm-hmm. in the Capitol. He did the Bucks deal, and we'll talk a little bit about the buses, $26 million for new buses. But when he comes knocking on legislators in the governor's office, I'd like to consider merging with the very healthy state pension system. Are they going to listen?
That's a good question. I don't want to venture a guess about that right now.
Okay. It's just very fascinating. It's something else we got to watch. Okay. On Tuesday, Governor Walker went to the Milwaukee Rotary, noon Rotary, and he said his budget would move Milwaukee forward if it was approved by the Republican legislature. I just want to, GOP leges, excuse me. I just want to look at some points in the governor's budget that would deal with Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. As we said, it would advance $26 million to buy new transit buses, replacing the buses that are least efficient and most polluting. And if you look at his additional K-12 aid, I'm referring here to the $200 million per pupil upper in year one, $204 year two. I asked the Fiscal Bureau to score it. That's $48 million more for MPS. MPS would also get $2.8 million for summer school programs. The capital budget of Governor Walker, $85 million for new UW-Milwaukee campuses. And the city's got a shot at a Southeast Wisconsin Law Enforcement Center. So the governor says this moves Milwaukee forward. When you hear this list, JR, what's your reaction?
Well, the governor's got money to hand around. I mean, that's the reality of, if you look at what Fiscal Bureau produced in January for revenue estimates, they're flush with cash. So they can do all these things. And Governor Walker, it is setting up to be a reelection budget. So he's making lots of people happy by spreading things around. He's got tax cuts in there. He's got aid to schools in there. He's got all these kind of like Christmas trees, Christmas tree ornaments adorned on his budget. In a lot of ways, it's a very giving budget for a lot of good places.
But traditionally, out-state Republicans have not been too fond of Milwaukee. They've been calling it a drain on the state, and we'll hear a Barrett quote on that pretty soon. So do you think they're more inclined with more cash to give Milwaukee some of these initiatives?
The issue that I keep hearing from Republicans right now is like they just don't know how they're going to figure this thing out in terms of transportation. That is the one big holdup they have. Also, they know that if there's plenty of money in the budget to move around if they want to, but if they move it around, the places that Walker put it are in K-12, UW system, kind of like politically popular places for that money to be parked. If they move it, they're going to get dinged for pulling money out of K-12 to pay for roads, for example. Let's just use that one example. So how do you maneuver that? Another big thing to watch. Every May, the Fiscal Bureau does a re-estimate of the state's finances. So we get this January estimate. We usually get one in May.
Prior to JFC voting.
Lots of times lawmakers pin their hopes on Bob Lang finding more money. That's not a guarantee, though. I went back and looked at history of this. It's not always the case. And I remember very well 2001 when it came back saying, oh, by the way, you've got less money than you think you did.
Here are numbers you don't like and don't want to hear.
And this is also the January upper was predicated upon this assumption of like all these things happening with tax policy in Washington and trade. What happens if they don't pan out? What happens if Republicans can't get their stuff together in Washington and pass a budget or a tax break that won't produce this kind of cash we're expecting? Those are like a lot of question marks right now that could put them in a tough position about whether they have the money for even just to do Walker's budget, let alone do extra stuff for roads.
So when we were in Milwaukee City Hall interviewing Mayor Barrett, I also asked him, how do you play offense when the highest ranking Milwaukee Democrat is Senator Lena Taylor, one of 16 members on the Joint Finance Committee? How do you play offense on the governor's budget? Here's what Mayor Barrett said.
I want people to know that the new Milwaukee is not a drain on the state. In fact, there's a Milwaukee dividend. What we did is we went back and looked at State Department of Revenue numbers from 2007, 2008 in a wide range of categories as to how much money came to the city, the county, and the school district. And we also looked at the money that was generated from the city of Milwaukee that went to the state. Using the state's own numbers and comparing apples to apples, what we found was that there is a Milwaukee dividend to the tune of about $460 million that the state is getting above what it sends back here to the city, county, and state. So to answer your question, we'd like some recognition that the city of Milwaukee is really an asset to the state.
Now, I went back to the mayor's office and I said a couple things I need to explain. When the mayor talks about a Milwaukee dividend, you say that's based on State Department of Revenues from 2008 to 2015, correct? Yes. Okay, the mayor used the term $460 million. Is that $460 million a year that Milwaukee and Milwaukee County sends to state government and it doesn't get back? Yes. So he says the Milwaukee dividend is $460 million a year. Do you think any Republicans in the Capitol cares about that number?
No, I think WPRL said its own calculation and kind of speeded the mayor's numbers, but Milwaukee has an issue and always has. I mean, like anywhere I've lived, the biggest thing in the state always gets dinged as being the drain for everybody else and pulling the resources away. And so Milwaukee is going to have that issue going forward.
Well, it's also interesting. The mayor in that interview said, look, our police department is our public safety is our number one issue. Its budget, if you don't count pension payments, $302 million. We have a property tax levy of $263 million, and we only get about $217 million in shared revenue aids. So the mayor said, my number one wish from the state budget is public safety to keep this city safe.
And the counter from Republicans has been, well, look, mayor, you've got this money for your
streetcar.
They call it the trolley. You've got money for the trolley. Why are you putting money in that if you're not going to put – you're asking us for more, but you've got money for that. How is that making – so obviously there are – different pots of money. Part of that's paid by the streetcar paid with federal aid, but they're having a hard time justifying, well, you keep asking us for more, but you're spending resources that we don't appreciate. So what do you do there?
Well, and the mayor said, we have reinvented the city. You come down there, you see all the construction cranes, and oh yeah, we got this trolley that's going to run down the heart of major drag. Okay, the Elections Commission, let's talk about that. They reported to both houses of the ledge some voting issues last year, both in the primary. They said more than 70 17-year-olds voted in the primary saying, look, we will be 18 by the November 8th general election. That's 70 statewide, 9 in Kewaunee County, 7 in Rock, 5 in Racine. Big deal?
Yes and no. No, because from what I can tell so far, nobody's going to get charged. Now, here's the thing about state law. You can register when you're 17, so long as you're going to be 18 by the election. So you can, as long as you're 18, you vote. These guys and the Chair of the Elections Commission kind of blamed Bernie Sanders' campaign originally, then pulled back a little bit. But spurred by social media posts, they said, okay, we can go vote. So they show up at the polls, they're registered, say, or register at the polls, say, hey, we can vote because it'll be 18 by November 8th. Election. The poll workers, a lot of them said, no, you can't, turn them away. But in these various places, they did not, either were convinced by these 17-year-olds or didn't know the law or whatever, and allowed them to vote. Right. So that is a problem. So it raises the question of training for poll workers. Should they have, you know, look, you have to show an ID now. You see the birthday, you know what, how old they are. So does there need to be an added layer of like a requirement to check their IDs for the age? Do they need better training? You know, what do you do to try and address this going forward? So there, that is an issue to take up. But anybody get charged? I don't see it right now. There might be, maybe, but we haven't heard anybody say it.
The Election Commission also reported that five felons voted. Well, I looked it up. There were presidential votes cast 2.9 million. That's not, I mean, no felon should vote. It's against the law, but
and this is
five?
An issue that voter ID does not fix this because, remember, when you go to vote, you sign a paper poll book, right? We don't have electronic poll books. So whether it's voting twice or being a felon who's voting, we don't have real-time checks. We do have a system now we can go catch this afterward and find out what happened and charge them. But in Wisconsin, if you are a felon, a convicted felon or released, as long as you're off parole and probation, you can vote. But if you're still under supervision, you can't vote. And that's the issue there. Some of you guys weren't off supervision yet and went and voted. Again, you can't catch it real time right now with what we have, though.
Right. And just one more thing on the Elections Commission. They are pleading with the legislature. They lose their HAVA money. Mm-hmm. And the governor's budget, they now have 22 full-time employees. They lose six of those under the governor's budget. They're asking for those to be reinstated. Okay, stock report.
So rising. So John Chisholm, Waukee County DA, he is going to have a target on his back the rest of his political career from conservatives because of what he did with John Doe 1 and John Doe 2. Remember, these are like the investigations he did in which he first went after aides of then Milwaukee County Scott Walker for doing some things on county time they shouldn't have been doing. And then B, that morphed in John Doe 2, which was an investigation of the groups that supported Scott Walker in the recall election and Scott Walker's campaign itself. Several groups who were unhappy about the tactics he used have been suing him left and right about this, but they keep coming up short. The last was McIver Institute, conservative group, filed a lawsuit in federal court alleging that Chisholm and members of the old GAB had basically violated federal law by the way they got electronic communication without kind of telling them first. Judge shot it down. They promised to appeal. But it's a lazy example of where they've gone after him but failed. Now, the thing is, this is not going to be the end of it. While McIver appealing, Cindy Archer, former Walker aide who former sued
DOA,
John Chisholm
yes.
and his top, she has a case pending for the Seventh Court Appeals right now. They had oral arguments in January, waiting for a decision there. I mean, he is going to be perpetually targeted, but they have not found a way to take him down yet. Remember, back in August, they went after him in the primary, right? Veronica Swanigan,
yes.
who was kind of seen as this kind of conservative Democrat who was backed by these Chisholm opponents. She didn't get anywhere.
She had no traction.
And then he had a fundraiser this week, and his name was kind of floated as maybe a candidate for governor, which I can tell you Republicans I talked to would love the chance to go after him statewide. I don't know if that's going to happen, but he just keeps winning in court when it comes to these nuisance, these kind of targeting lawsuits.
I do not see him as a candidate for governor in 2018 as a Democrat. Okay, mixed.
So speaking of candidates for governor in 2018 as governor, so yes. Tim Cullen, we've been talking about this kind of mushy field of Democrats right now, and I say mushy because there's no heir apparent to run for the party, right?
Six or seven different names out there.
Tim Cullen is one of the few ones right now who's making like concrete moves toward a run. This week, he opened a bank account, start raising money, change his registration with the Ethics Commission or Elections Commission so he can be a candidate for governor. Now, he's saying, nothing's official. I'll announce next month, but I can't see what would tell me I'm not going to do it. So he's out there. He's moving toward it, but Cullen doesn't really excite the base right now, the operative class that I talked to. They're not really thrilled about the idea of somebody who is, I think, 70 years old, who kind of had his moment of the sun years ago, being the standard bearer for a party that needs new blood. I've also heard this week Matt Flynn. I talked to him.
Former lieutenant governor?
No, Matt Flynn, a Milwaukee attorney who
yes,
ran for the House three times, the Senate once, lost all of those, former state Democratic chair, been an attorney in Milwaukee for a long
Not
time.
Not a member of the youth movement.
No.
Okay.
So he's talking about it. What's interesting is there are all these names of people who are thinking about running for governor. What it tells you is lots of people think there's an opportunity, but they're not really there yet in terms of like laying down a foundation for a campaign. There's a 24 or 25 year old guy who graduated from Stanford, Wisconsin native.
He called me yesterday. His name is Bob Harlow. He's working in his Barneveld family business. Go ahead, excuse me.
He ran for Congress last year in California. Now he's going to make the transition run for governor of Wisconsin 2 years later.
Yeah.
People are excited about that so far. But again, you know, Walker's poll numbers last year were not very good, and even a year and a half, because he ran for president, left the state.
And we'll get new numbers next week.
From Marquette, cannot wait for those. Our first chance to look at some poll numbers in Wisconsin. But there seem to be some vulnerabilities for Scott Walker, right? Plus, you add in that President Trump, what's that number going to be like next year? I mean, his poll numbers aren't, depending on which poll you look at,
right,
his numbers are either really bad or like just kind of okay. Yeah. But if it's a bad environment in 18, there's all kinds of opportunities. But then again, you go, Walker, okay, this budget he produced, it's a re-election budget. He's giving out this money to everybody. There's no clear...
reform dividend, he calls it.
There's no clear challenger, so it's not... Democrats are in a tough position. The lack of a deep bench is really biting him right now.
Tim Cullen mixed. Okay, falling.
So Lowell Holtz, this DPI superintendent race has not popped at all so far. I've been asking people for weeks, any signs of TV ads from conservative groups? And the answer has been, no, not yet. Now, that could change. We are... So Tuesday is 2 weeks out from the race. You need to be up on TV, either like as of Tuesday or by Friday of next week, to even have a chance to make this a race. Right now, we don't see it. I've been checking TV buys. I've been asking my sources. They're not seeing it. And part of it is that Lowell Holtz is seen as a flawed candidate in some ways. So this week, the latest drip, drip, drip for him was when he was superintendent at one school, he donated bleachers to the private school where his kids attended. Now, his answer was, it saved us money, had them come take them and have them disassembled and take them.
We got rid of bleachers that we were going to get rid of anyway.
But the board wasn't happy they didn't go through the board first. You know, it's all these little things. He got one piece of good news this week.
The Elections Commission dropped a complaint against him.
But it just rehashed for people, oh, that's right. This guy had a conversation with John Humphreys, another challenger to Tony Evers, about, okay, if one of us leaves the race and you win, what kind of job do I get paid with taxpayer money? You know, do I get a driver? Do I get control of Milwaukee Public Schools? What's going to happen?
And I think $140,000 a year.
And the other thing is, you know, this is a low-profile race to start with. But when I'm checking, like, media around the state, I'm not seeing Lowell Holtz pop up in the Green Bay market, in the Rhineland market, the La Crosse. We're not seeing a campaign where they're really kind of taking advantage of the opportunity to be in the local media and get some attention. So they seem to be banking on Talk Radio Milwaukee and outside groups come in and save them, and I don't know if they're going to right now.
I think that's a good call. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind for March 17th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal: enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.